Okay, good afternoon. Let's start. Apparently the microphone isn't charged again, so I'll have to be standing here again. Maybe next week. Right, today's topic is words, 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 which is a Shakespeare quotation. You can go and find it yourself, unless you know it already. But basically, it's a simpler way of referring to looking at words and their structure and their meanings. In other words, morphology. This is the main topic for today. Before we do this, as usual, there will be a few announcements. Some of you may have noticed that I've uploaded what I call no list for phonetics and phonology to StudIP. As I said last time, or maybe even earlier, depending on whether it's boldface or normal within brackets, it means whether it's really, really, really important, or just really important, or just important or nice to know. Okay, so this is meant to give you some help in navigating the jungle of terminology and concepts that I'm asking you to walk through with me. Right. Some people have contacted me about problems accessing the audio recordings or also the video, the streaming. This is partly because in the original PDF which I uploaded, there was a line break in an odd place, which then resulted in two hyphens rather than just one hyphen between University of Trier or Uni Trier, which then didn't work. I guess a few people just thought that can't be right, others didn't. I think everyone knows by now. I think I've also changed the PDF, so if you're still having trouble accessing, then please get in touch with me. Some of you will also have seen that I was rather late in uploading the assignment. I said sometime over the weekend or next week. Well, it only happened this morning. It's still this week. And you've got now more than 2 weeks, so a full 2 weeks plus the weekend plus another Monday to do this. And I hope you don't find this just merely tedious. As I said last time, there is a good reason why I'm asking these questions. For example, in one question, I ask how many chapters a particular book has. Well, that's not because I want to test whether you can count to 15 or 13 or whatever, however many chapters there might be, but I would like you to notice the book and where it is, and maybe not just look at how many chapters there are, but, oh, this is an interesting book, because it is a book that you will be possibly seeing again over the next three years. So even though it might seem silly, there's usually, or I think in all questions, there's something behind it that makes me ask this question. Right. I think sometime over the last two lectures, I also made the point that some of the sounds that I introduced or that you will find in the IPA chart do not exist in English. And I think in the context of München, I said that sh doesn't exist in English. And that's not really true. It is sort of there if you listen to some people who say huge or pure. So it's not that that English speakers cannot produce this, but it's not, and that's the important point, it's not a sound that creates a phonemic contrast. And you should now be in a position to understand what I mean by creating a phonemic contrast. Okay. If not, I'll give you one last help. Sort of phone versus phoneme, take three. Okay? Because I noticed from emails that I get that there are still some open questions. Can you read this? Yes, no problem. Right? Scissors. If I ask you the question, and this is kind of dangerous what I'm doing now because I'm going back to spelling, but I hope I can still make that point. How many different letters are there? Four. S, C, I, Five. Okay. Yeah. Everyone agrees there are five different letters. Yeah. Is there anyone who doesn't agree? Well, are the duplicates really duplicates? Is the first S the same as the second and the third S? Don't they all look different? You have absolutely no problems with that, do you? I mean, you can read them all as S's because you know, depending on where in the word it occurs, it might have a different form. And even those two in the middle are not exactly the same. Well, they're actually quite different. And the one at the end is again slightly different. But you have no problems with this, do you? They look different, but are the same. They're the letter S. And you know why they look different. In other words, although they are different, they have the same function in the system. Namely, they are the letter S. Or, as we could say, the grapheme S. Grapheme ends with eme, like phoneme. And if we look at these instantiations, realizations of the grapheme S, then you can see that they have different forms. They're different graphs. And in fact, we could say that those two are allographs of the same grapheme. Well, many people call them glyphs, but really, it's allographs. And you have absolutely no problems understanding this. So why do you have problems understanding it when it's about phones and phonemes? Because it's exactly the same thing. Same is true for sounds. Different realizations, but the same phoneme. Okay. Now, as I said, this is dangerous because I've now introduced spelling again, but spelling and pronunciation, for the seventh time, are not the same thing. I know you confuse this. I know people in the fifth semester confuse this. It just isn't the same. In German, there is a very strong connection between spelling and pronunciation. In English, there isn't. So just to spell this out again, the fact that the two words, or that two words are spelled the same way, does not mean that they have the same phonemes. The fact that two words sound the same way does not mean that they have the same spelling. But we can talk about the system of sounds of English and how different sounds make up the same phonemes. Right. This is the last time I'm going to say anything about the difference between phonemes and phones in terms of actually explaining it. If you've still not understood it, if you've had problems or if you haven't done the exercises yet, if you're having problems doing the exercises, you need to check because without this, it's going to be difficult. All right? Okay, let's move over to morphology then, where in fact we'll be talking about morphemes and morphs. And you can probably already see where this is going, because as I said, this kind of difference goes through the whole system. Now if you, everyone knows what a word is, but if you go out on the street, and ask lay people, it's kind of difficult for them to explain what it is. And even for linguists, there might be disagreements about what exactly is a word. Okay. One way to define a word could be, since we've now got all this terminology, a phoneme or several phonemes. We saw that a word can be just one phoneme, or bounded by pauses. But remember, last time when we talked about connected speech, we saw that things hang together and that, in fact, in connected speech, certain things happen that don't seem to suggest that there are always pauses between words. I'm not producing lots of pauses now. The only pauses that I produce are small pauses when I produce a plosive. And in that sense, there is some sort of, I stop making sound for a fraction of a second. But that's not what's meant by pause. If you say those two sequences of words, it's the same, but it's different words that are involved. So quite clearly, we can't say that this definition is going to help us. I'd like to set you counting again. This is my favorite sentence in the context of introducing morphemes or words and morphology. How many words do you count? The cook was a good cook, and as cooks go, she went. Well, obviously the point is it depends. It depends on how you count. And depending on your definition of word, which may make full sense within the system that you use, you come to a different conclusion. And I'd like to go through one or two options to make that point a bit more clearly. You could take a sort of computational definition of word, a string of uninterrupted non-punctuation characters with white space or punctuation at each end. And you could then set a computer to count words in a document. Microsoft Word is probably doing it like that. That's the basic assumption. Yeah. Now, this is what we would call an orthographic word, because we have an orthographic definition of what is and what is not a word. And I spoke to a former colleague of mine at Lancaster University, who's also the editor or one of the co-editors of the book, gave me this a while ago to make the point, or used it in his classes as well, that this is not necessarily a natural division. Okay, this may sound or may look familiar to you. To mum and dad, this is from one of his daughters. I like you and I love you, love from Emily. Now, as you can see, this, I don't know how old she was, I forgot, rather young girl, did not seem to have the concept of word internalized yet, because, she wrote everything in one go. So, it seems that it's not a natural division, but let's look at some other divisions or some other definitions of words. How about I've had 3 haircuts within 5 weeks? How many words, how many orthographic words is easy? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. But maybe you're not that happy with this. Because is I've a word? Is haircuts one word? In English, as I'll say later, it is possible to write compounds without hyphens. Does that make it 2 words? Is it still not still 1 word? There are some problems involved here. So clearly, if we just take an orthographic definition, then we are reaching the limits of what makes sense sometimes. It's very convenient if you want to use a computer, but really from a linguistic point of view, it may sometimes make sense to say, I would like to split it up further. I asked you to count the number of words, but maybe this time I'd like to ask you how many different words. It's like the question how many different letters were there in scissors. How many different words? And you'll see that cook happens twice. All the others only exist once. So, if we want to count the number of words of the same type, then the answer would be 1 lower than if you just count the different orthographic words. No, the individual orthographic words, not the the different ones. Some people, and this is something that you will hear again in year 2 and year 3, etc., make the distinction between type and token counts. If I count every single orthographic word here, and in other words, count cook twice, then I'm counting tokens. But if I say that we have the same word twice, the same type cook twice, the same token twice, then we can sort of combine this together into the type. Okay. So we have two words that really can only be counted as one if you take a type approach. Is that clear? Hope so. Is a word a unit of meaning? Can we just count units of meaning? Well, the plane landed. Plane we have no problems with. That's clearly a word. Landed is the. What's the meaning of the? Yeah, it's a grammatical word, but let's say it's not controversial either, so we could say clearly three words. What about the plane took off? Is take in took off a word on its own and a unit of meaning of its own? Well, it's a phrasal verb and it's one word in that sense, if we take word as a unit of meaning. Many of you will know he kicked the bucket. This is not a literal kicking, although you could, but this is an idiom or an expression that means he died. Is kicked the bucket one word? Is it three words? Well, it's an idiomatic expression and it makes sense to call it a unit of meaning. So if you take meaning as a basis, you come to a completely different or potentially different conclusion as to the number of words than when you take an orthographic definition. Just now we looked at the cook sentence and we saw that the word cook happens twice, and I introduced the distinction between type and token. But we could also say, well, there is the word go and there is the word went, and isn't that the same word? Well, it's clearly related. It's not the same orthographic form. But we could say that there are only nine words, because cook, okay, happens twice, but even the word go happens twice. Once in the base form and once in the past tense. Now here's another word ending in eem. These words are lexemes because they are abstract in the same way as graphemes are abstract, as phonemes are abstract, and as we will see, as morphemes are abstract. What do I mean by abstract? Well, you don't see the lexeme go. You see the word went, which is a realization of the lexeme go. Or you see go, the actual orthographic word, which is a realization of the lexeme go. So what is a lexeme? As I said, it's an abstract concept. You can't see it. You only see the realization of it, in the same way as you can't really see what you have in your brain about phonemes, the knowledge of which sounds are part of the English system. Lexemes are abstract. The word forms of the lexemes are not abstract. They are the ones that you see, that they're the ones that you produce. Just to give you another example, the lexeme walk has various word forms. He walks like a duck. He is walking like a duck. He walked like a duck. Or he started to walk like a duck. And yes, there are four different orthographic words, but they belong together. They all belong together to the lexeme walk. And the convention is to take the base form or the form of the infinitive. But that's just a convention. In the same way as we say that the phoneme, which is indicated with the letter or the symbol T, or that we would use in spelling for, as a letter T, includes the glottal stop and t, but we just decided that it's t rather than glottal stop, which we take as a symbol to show this. So all of these belong together to one lexeme, namely walk. And we can count lexemes rather than word forms in a text. Okay, the last one, or the next one, is a bit contrived, but just to make the point. Dean read the book versus Dean has read the book. We have the same orthographic form, we have the same lexeme, but there is something different about this, well, there's two instances of read, even though they're really, well, they even pronounce the same. The grammatical function in the system is different, so that's why some people say it's a different word, because it is realizing a different grammatical function. But as I said, this is a fairly contrived example that maybe is not at the forefront of your mind when you start counting words. So as you've seen, there are quite a few different ways of counting words, and depending on which version you choose, you will reach different results. So the definition of what is a word isn't easy, or isn't simple, or straightforward. Let's have a quick look at other languages and the forms that some words take. And in English, we say we think. Now, my Spanish isn't good. Well, it's virtually non-existent, but it's something like pensamos. Pensiamo, Italian. Wir denken. And in French, nous pensons, or something like that. And you can see that in different languages, well, different numbers of words are used to express the same concept, the same meaning. In Spanish and Italian, we don't need a pronoun. Okay. The element which is included in Spanish is needed in French and in German and in English. But there is something about the endings, so those of you who know French and Spanish or Italian, that makes up for the fact that the pronoun isn't there. If a Spanish person says pensamos, it is clear to the listener that it is we. It can't be I. If an English person says think, it could be I or we. So there is grammatical information encoded in the word pensamos, or in the verb, which somehow, well, not somehow, which isn't encoded in the same way in English. So different words have, or different parts of words, seem to carry different types of meaning. We have a lexical meaning for think. We have a lexical meaning somewhere hidden in pensamos, but there is an additional meaning which says plural, first person. And in fact also present tense. Now when we're talking about elements of words that carry these types of meaning, then we are talking about morphology, so we're going inside the words to look at the structure of words and how this structure creates meaning or contains meaning. Right. A brief word on categorization of words. And I think I may have briefly mentioned this before, but the distinction between open and closed class should be clear. Or some people say content versus grammatical, or lexical versus function. Well, there are some words, some word classes, which are open in the sense that they allow new members quite easily. Nouns. Well, there can be new nouns, well, 10 new nouns per day, and that's no problem for the English language. 10 new prepositions a day? No, doesn't happen. So that's why this class, the preposition, is a closed class. Here's a brief overview, a basic one, over the different, the two different types. We have nouns, lexical verbs, adjectives, and adverbs, although this is a bit of a tricky category belonging to open class words. And the closed class words include determiners, prepositions, pronouns, conjunctions, and auxiliary verbs like should and might and could. Now, it's a myth that these categories are clear-cut. And I might come back to this later on in the course. Sometimes it is not easy to say whether it's a verb or an adjective or an adverb or a preposition. That doesn't need to concern us too much, but I'd like to give you one or two examples nevertheless. So we have fuzzy-edged categories, and as I said, adverbs are particularly problematic. Before I give you the examples, it may also be useful to know the terms primary verbs, be, do, and have, which can be either full verbs or main verbs, I have a car, or auxiliary verbs, and therefore helping other verbs as it, well, auxiliary, it helps. So, I am making, am is an auxiliary verb, but if I say I am happy, am is not an auxiliary verb. And depending on where we put them into that, well, depending on what it is, it's either part of an open class or a closed class, word class. A few things can be said about the difference between open and closed class. Meaning-wise, open class words like nouns or verbs tend to be fairly specific. They have clear-cut meanings, usually, many of them. Some of them less so, but that's generally the case. Whereas closed class, I mean, what's the meaning of the? It's not specific. Or some prepositions have a lot of different meanings. Over. Over can mean all sorts of things. Open class words are typically low to medium frequency. And closed class words are very, very frequent, typically. The word the happens about 6 times out of 100 words in the English language. So every 100 words you will count, you will meet on average 6 times the word the. And open class words can change quite quickly. There can be new words, but with closed class words, a preposition that was formed once is likely to stay for a couple of hundred years. There can be change over time. What's the word class of absent? That's not a university question. That's a sort of... Well, my 9-year-old son should be able to do this. What's the word? Yes?
It's open.
Open, yes, but... and which one in particular?
Adjective,
okay. He is absent, okay. So, part of an open class, word class, and it's an adjective. Okay. Have a look at this. Can a constable, when authorized by Section 7.3 of the Act to require a specimen of blood, etc., oh no, we're here already, and absent any medical opinion? Is that an adjective? That sounds like without any medical opinion. So, what word class does it have here? Just purely on the basis of where it is. It's a preposition. So is absent a preposition? Well, it seems to be becoming a preposition. It started a while ago in legal language, but nowadays it is actually possible to find it in linguistic textbooks, in general books, that, well, it seems to have moved from adjective to preposition. But this is a really rare case. Just to make the point that these categories are not fixed and not always clear-cut. This is specialized knowledge that I don't expect you to know by heart and things like that. But occasionally, for people who are interested, I'd like to give you a bit more than just the basics, even though this is Ling 101. And the last, or the next slide, is actually part of this. I mean, we have no problems with seeing that with is a preposition. With him, with her. Notwithstanding any whatever opposition, etc., etc. That's also a preposition, a formal preposition, and one which you can see, I think, has been formed from various words. There is not and with and standing in it. So it seems to have fused from three different words that have become one preposition. Instead of, stede meant place in Middle English. Nowadays we spell it with two words. Probably, give it another 200 years, maybe we'll only spell it with one orthographic word. In front of is three words still. And in acknowledgement of, well, is really sort of still three separate words, but can be used in the same slot where we would expect one preposition. So there seems to be some sort of gradients between very, very clear primary core prepositions and elements which can sort of be counted as prepositions, but we can also say, well, this is still a noun which is surrounded by two prepositions. So the concept of gradients, this is something that you might find again in about 2 years' time when you're doing a Ling 501. Right, let's go back to the basics again. In a sentence like, the lecture greatly expanded their knowledge, we have words like greatly, which I think you will have no problems splitting up into great and li. You know that great is a word in English. And you will also have no problems splitting this up into expand and ed. Some of you might even attempt to say ex, pand, and ed, but then start thinking, wait a minute, is pand the word? What's the meaning of these parts? That's the question I would like to ask first. We have no problem saying what the meaning of great and expand is with li and ed. Is it as clear? Well, let's leave li for the moment. What's the meaning of ed? Past tense. In the same way as pensiamos contained information about first person singular plural. What about knowledge? Is it know and ledge? Well, there is a word ledge in English, and it's even spelt like this. But this ledge doesn't mean the other ledge. So knowledge is really one unit of meaning, one could say, even though the word know is in there. It doesn't make sense to split it up into things that have individual meanings. If you go back in the history of the language, maybe that's different. But we're just looking at it from the present day point of view now. We could also say, and this is more technical terminology, ledge is not a productive suffix. I can't attach it to other stems and produce new words in a productive way. So I've introduced some words now and said that they have, or I've looked at some words and I've said that they have parts and that these parts have meaning. And that's basically the definition of a morpheme. A morpheme, and I'll just read this out, is the smallest meaningful unit of a language. Meaningful unit. Remember the definition of phoneme? Meaning distinguishing unit. Now, this is the smallest meaningful unit of a language. It cannot be further divided into elements that carry meanings. It can be further divided into elements that may be meaning distinguishing, namely the sounds. But these sounds themselves do not carry meaning. So, a word like untruthful. Un plus truth plus full. And I'd like to introduce some terminology here. And I don't think this is going to be difficult for you. Prefix, suffix, and they both are part of a larger category which is called affixes. There are also infixes and interfixes, more important for other languages, but not really in English. What about the word unloads? It also contains three parts. We've got the same un, okay, and then the word load, and then something, well, an ending which indicates, well, what is it? We again have a prefix, un, a suffix, s, and a stem or a root, some people call it, depending on what they prefer. And what does the suffix mean here? Third person singular. Now, what does the third person singular suffix do to the root? What's the difference between load and loads? Does it create a new lexeme? Does it create the same, or is it? Does it create something which is the same lexeme but just a different word form? Yes, the second is the case. And that's why we call this type of morph or morpheme a inflectional morph. Because what it produces is not a new lexeme, but just another example or another word form of the same lexeme. If we want to look up load and loads in a dictionary, then we will do this under the same word, namely load. If we look up great and greatly, then we will do this in two different dictionary entries. What's the meaning of the prefix un? Well, opposite. What does it do? Does it create a new word in the sense of new lexeme? Yes. It derives a new lexeme out of an old one. And that's why we call it derivational morph. So there are two types of affixes in English. Well, there are two types in the sense of prefixes and affixes. There are suffixes, yes. But there are also two types, namely derivational and inflectional morphemes. This is a very basic distinction which you will need to be able to assign if I give you a sentence and say, find morphemes that find all the different morphological parts. You will have to be able to distinguish between inflectional morphs and derivational ones. And the root is sometimes called, or usually called, the lexical morph. Or, yeah. As a hint, that's something to know. It always helps. There are no prefixes that are inflectional. Now, you may have noticed that I've said morph and morpheme, and I've sort of not been consistent. So what is this distinction between morpheme and morph? And here we go again. Remember, phoneme, lexeme, grapheme. Again, abstract concept versus realization. Again, something which we don't really see, but which has meaning or which is a concept, and the actual form that we see used in a word. And again, And usually students find this easier to understand than the phoneme versus phone distinction. I'd like to again show this to you with an example. How do people form the plural in English? Well, if we have a word like hat, obviously it's hats. And the morph used is the voiceless sound s. Now, in citation form, although not necessarily in actual speech, in connected speech, the plural of dogs also has an S. Yes, spelling, but in terms of how it is produced, we have dogs. Now, in effect, this is also very often devoiced, but because the G, because G is a voiced consonant, this has an influence on how the plural morpheme is realized. It's realized as a voiced sound. What's the plural of ox? Oxen, right? A very old-fashioned plural. Still a few of those around, remnants from before. So we could say that the realization of the plural here is an. What's the plural of sheep? Some people say sheeps, but it isn't, it's sheep. Okay. So it's really zero, isn't it? It still is the plural, but the morph that realizes the plural isn't there. Now all of these mean the same thing, plural. Notice that I put curly brackets around. So if they all mean the same thing, and this is the morpheme and they are all morphs, what are they? Allomorphs. Okay? Right. Almost halfway through, I'd like to give you 3 minutes of break this time, but I'll give you something to do as well. This is something that could happen in an exam. Here's the dreaded word again. He reconsidered the proposal and hunted down the left-handed waiter. Find all morphemes, or in other words, draw boundaries between morphemes. Tell me whether the morphemes, or the things that you see, the realizations, the morphs, are lexical, derivational, or inflectional. And can you find any allomorphs in the sentence? And I'll give you 2 to 3 minutes for that, 3 minutes. And then I'll do the second part of the lecture. Okay. Let's see whether you found what I hope you have found. I've colored the individual types on the slide here, where everything that's red is a lexical morpheme, or the actual, well, the morph that you see, but it's lexical. Notice that left-handed, the hyphen in between is not red, so it's actually two morphemes. The green ones, there are only three. They're derivational. Reconsider. Now, if some of you said that con and sider is two morphemes, well, then you're basically going back to Latin morphology, which you can do, but then that's something different, because the word today is no longer made up of two parts. Same with propose, I guess. And the inflectional ones are, well, they're also three. Did anyone find any allomorphs in the sentence? Well, if I ask a question like that, then there are two that are allomorphs of the same morpheme.
Weren't there already past tenses, so reconsider, counted, and yeah.
And yeah, exactly. I'm happy that you didn't go on, yes? All the past tenses, yes. He reconsidered and hunted. So it's the same form, it's the same spelling, but we're not producing it in the same way. One is ud, the other one is id. And why is id in left-handed not part of the game? It isn't, because it's not the past tense. Right? You said all the past tenses, but left-handed is not a verb in the past tense. Now, id is also a morph. Morpheme, yeah. But it's not of the same morpheme. It doesn't belong to the same morpheme, and therefore cannot be an allophone with the other morphs that mean past tense. If this isn't clear, think about it, and I hope that makes it clear. If not, let me know. Right. Some light fare that is related to morphology. I think I've already mentioned that I like Calvin and Hobbes. Last time, Hobbes wasn't there. For those of you who don't know Calvin and Hobbes, you really ought to. It's brilliant stuff. I need help on my homework. What's a pronoun? A noun that lost its amateur status. Maybe I can get a point for originality. This makes a morphological point, or this joke. It's always bad to explain jokes, right? But this makes a morphological point. Prefixes have meanings, and there may be the same prefix that has different meanings. Pro can mean not an amateur. But of course, pronoun, as we will also see in the next few lectures when we're talking about syntax, means for a noun. And there are many words like that. So, Hobbes has deliberately, assuming, well, I don't know, has misunderstood the meaning of the morpheme. Right. Okay, two more. Don't know whether you can see this. Relief. This is from Wiley's dictionary. I don't know whether you know this. What the trees do in spring, or in the spring. What do trees do in spring? They re-leaf. Yeah. So again, misunderstanding or misconstrual of the morphological structure. The morphological structure of the English word relief, being meaning I am relieved that this is the case, is not re and leaf. Okay. The next one I'm not going to say much because it's always fun to show this, because some people get it after 5 seconds, some others after sort of 15, and then usually after about 45 seconds the last person says, or maybe not the last, says, ah, but let's see. This is a, and I'm not making fun of you, it's just... I heard one laughter already. Next one. Do you know the word adamant? Okay, next person. Yes. Yes. I am adamant that you really need to know about the difference between phonemes and phones. Okay, I'm very determined. What's the structure? What's the morphological of structure? Well, not Adam, the first man, and ant, but it's one morpheme. Okay? Right. Quite a few linguistic jokes use this, and some are more difficult to get than others. There are many of this type. If you're interested, there is a link that I can give you to these kind of jokes. Some of them are really better than others. There are some really bad ones. What is the definition of copulate? A policeman who misses an appointment. Ha ha ha, yes. Why is that not a good joke? Well, it's partly not a good joke because it doesn't really use the normal morphological rules that we would have in English. There is no infix you in English. This is not the way a word would be formed in English. So that's why I don't think this is a particularly good example. I like the adamant one. That's much better. Right, I've already now mentioned the next point, namely how do words come about, how are they formed, how do they become part of the lexicon of the English language, and that's when we're in the area of word formation. There are quite a few, and I'm going to go through a list of these, and they'll be expected knowledge in the sense that you'll be able to list them, or more importantly, apply, well, if I show you a word, you should be able to show me or tell me which kind of process was involved in forming it. We've already met the word karaoke, and I think I briefly mentioned that it's a borrowing. That is something that happens very often, and one of the, well, English has a lot, thousands and tens of thousands of borrowed words, because of its history of contact with other languages. This is something that you'll be hearing much more about next semester. We've also already seen derivation. I said that a derivational suffix creates a new lexeme out of an old one. I didn't say the word create, but on the slide it actually said derives. That's because it's a derivational suffix. Prefix, and that's why we call about the word formation process of derivation. And most derivational suffixes are highly or quite productive. What does it mean to be productive for a morpheme? Well, it means that it can be used with many lexical roots. So, for example, a fairly recent one that has entered the language. Well, it's not only through the internet, but it has been spread much further because of the internet, is the prefix cyber. Cyberpunk, cyberbanking, cybersex, cybersquatter, etc. There are quite a few of those. All of these are examples of derivation. And we also know that affixes can be combined. There is a famous word, anti-disestablishmentarianism. Have to practice there. which is anti and dis and ment and ari and am and isn't. And they all mean something. Let's not go through it now, but they all mean something. So we can stack these affixes to create new lexemes out of old ones that may already have been formed from a previous derivation process. Compounding is easy, right? Two lexical morphemes are combined to form a new word. It's easy, yes, but there are still quite a few interesting things that can be said about it. Some things that I'm not going to talk about today, like where is it stressed, on the first part or on the second part? Usually on the first, but not always. Okay. But also which parts can be put together. With skinhead, it's a noun-noun compound. Pickpocket, verb noun, nosedive, noun and verb. Fast food, adjective and noun. Notice, and I briefly mentioned this earlier on already, in English, there is no need to write a hyphen or to put the words together as there traditionally is in German. It's coming more and more into German as well that you can do sort of the English type of writing two words next to each other. But these are one word as well. They're just compounds, toll plaza or road rage. Compounds are also interesting in terms of their meaning. Just, for example, what is a call girl? This is the OED example again. The OED as a source of data, sorry. And many of you will know that this is a prostitute who makes appointments by telephone. What's a call boy? According to the dictionary. Well, the male version of it, yes. But not only, apparently. I didn't know this before, either. A youth employed in theater to attend upon the prompter and call the actors when required on the stage. Or on a steamer to transmit the captain's orders to the engineer or to answer the bells. A messenger boy, a device for transmitting messages and orders, and then after call girl, a young male prostitute. So, I mean, as you can see, meanings are not necessarily just as straightforward forward as we expect, and we might come back to things like that when we do semantics, because there are all sorts of other things involved, connotations, there's also the question of language and gender. It is not unusual for terms referring to women to have negative or sexual overtones. A mistress is an example, but a master is has much fewer sexual connotations. Why is this? Well, these are elements that we can discuss further in the course, but they partly also rely on the fact that we create these words on the basis of derivational morphology, of compounding, sorry, today is not my day, and the meaning may actually not be what you expect it to be. What's an invisible mending specialist? Someone who fixes things that are broken, clothes, etc., in such a way that you don't see it, that the fixing is invisible. Of course, it could also mean that the specialist is invisible. But it doesn't. Why? Anyway. Next process, shortening. And shortening can be split up into several subtypes. Clippings. We talk about phones, and we don't usually talk about telephones. We talk about ads, but you can say advertisement or advertisement, depending on what you prefer. And we even have an option of clipping something off the word on both ends. So flu is influenza, but you say that you've got the flu and you don't say that you've got influenza, usually, unless you're a doctor, perhaps. Do you know the word pram? Does anyone have any children? Then they would know what a pram is. It's the vehicle that you transport your children in when they're young. A pram, a perambulator. Most British, most English speakers wouldn't know that pram comes from perambulator, but it's a clipping. We've got acronyms and we've got initialisms. The difference is that with acronyms, they are produced as if they were one word, so NATO, laser. With initialisms, you typically say each letter that makes up the initialism. So you don't say ASAP, although I've heard this, but you typically say ASAP or the YMCA. With BBC, you don't really have a choice, I guess. No. Right. And SMOG, infomercial and guesstimate, is something fairly new. It's only a process that was actually, I think, invented even by a person earlier, I think in the second half of the 19th century, when two words are fused together to form one new lexeme. So smoke and fog becomes smog. These are fairly easy, I think. Now, two that sometimes cause confusion. One is called conversion, or sometimes zero derivation, because the same thing happens as with derivation, in the sense that there is a new lexeme that is formed, but it's done on the basis of nothing. There is no morpheme that you can see. So, to bottle and the bottle is not the same word, but, well, it's not the same word in a sense. It's not the same dictionary entry. It's another word class. But it is done with a morpheme that you don't see, therefore zero derivation. To bridge the gap. Or to better. Or to dirty. Or a call is a conversion from the verb call. And the verb Facebook. Okay? Conversion. There is a process called invention, but it is very rare. Hardly any words are invented. Some people claim that nylon is an invented word. Nerd or blurb. What's a blurb? A blurb is what's on the back of a book when you read that this is a must read and it's absolutely brilliant and it's excellent and this, well, if you don't read it, then you're not going to pass the exam and things like that. Yeah. That's a blurb, among other things. These, well, inventions are very rare. Borrowings, yes, very frequent. Conversions, not very frequent, but still around. But inventions are very, very rare. Now, this is the one that sometimes causes confusion, back formation. Which one is earlier in the history of English? Editor or edit? Or beggar and beg? Or extrapolation and extrapolate. It looks as if we had edit, and then because there is an or suffix that exists with other words, or that we can use in other words, editor was formed. But in fact, it's the other way around. There was a word editor that was interpreted to be the result of a word formation process, and then the word that was never there in the first place was back formed from that word. In fact, peas comes from Latin, and it looked as if it was a plural, but it isn't, or it wasn't. And therefore the word pea was formed by way of back formation. Usually this doesn't happen with inflectional words, inflectional morphemes, but this is an example. So, to give you a definition, deletion of a wrongly identified suffix in the lexeme by analogy with other instances where the suffixed and non-suffixed forms are both lexemes. Okay, I'm using the terminology introduced, for example, lexeme. And suffix. One which is one last, I think it's the last, I'm not quite sure, the last word formation process that I would like to introduce is reduplication. This is very rare in English again. Some people say that helter-skelter or nitty-gritty is a case of reduplication, but I'm not 100% convinced. It's much more common in other languages. If anyone knows Malay or Indonesian, Bahasa Indonesia, then you may know that the plural, for example, is formed via reduplicating a word, or sometimes also to express, so to intensify it. Hati means danger, and hati-hati means watch out. Right. So, this was a brief overview of the most important word formation processes for English. Compounding is by far the most frequent one. Well, not by far, sorry. Is the most frequent one. There's only a difference. Yeah, okay. 27% derivation, 17% conversion, shortening 9%, blending 6%, borrowing nowadays fairly rare. If you go back to Old English and Middle English in particular, then that figure looks completely different. No, I don't expect you to know these percentages by heart. Okay. It would be nice to know that compounding is a very, very common one and derivation too. Okay. But whether it's 36%, or 17.5 or 88, I don't mind. Well, I mind, but I don't want to know from you. Right, so we've done morph and morpheme. We've done word formation, which relies on morphemes usually to be put together, lexical ones or derivational ones, or maybe even a zero morpheme, as in the case of conversion. And sort of the last thing I would like to talk about today is a bit about the lexicon and variation in the lexicon as well. Variation in the way the words that are part of the English language are used in different contexts by different people, etc. So it's all about words as well, but it's from a different point of view. I think all of you know what a dialect is. But many of you will probably have negative connotations when they hear the word dialect. It's a subordinate variety of language, right? Sometimes I hear people from the Saarland saying, oh, we only speak dialect, those kind of things. Or people from around Trier, the Eifel, etc. And somehow the assumption is that it's not quite as good German. Right? Now forget about that view from the point of view of linguistic structure or from the point of view of linguistic form. I think you should forget about it anyway, but particularly from a linguistic point of view, because everyone speaks a dialect, but we might just speak a standard dialect. There is a nice saying that is sometimes attributed to Max Weinreich, a language is a dialect with an army and the navy. It's just conventionalized. It's got dictionaries. It's got things to fight for it. It might have an Académie Française or something, or a Duden to fight for it. But in terms of linguistic realization, there is no difference in terms of quality or complexity. When we're talking about things like that, we're talking about regional and social dialects. Particularly in England, of course, differences between words or how you speak may indicate not only whether you're a northerner or a southerner, but also whether you're a working class or not person. Right? Now, regional is quite easy to show with a dictionary that is based on a survey of English dialects, which was done last century, a while ago, from 1948 and 1961. They asked people who lived in rural areas and who were elderly, because they're the most conservative ones, to say, for example, whether they lay or set the table. Now, I can't do this with you so much because you're not, well, very few of you will be native speakers of English or British English, but when I used to teach in Britain, I could try this out and say, who sets the table, and then a few people put up their hands, and who lays the table, and then the other group put their hands up. So there's still today a clear difference that is regional, depending on choices. And this is something that you can see in maps like this. So you set the table up here in the north of England, and towards the east, and in the south and the south west, you lay the table. So all the people in Lancaster who lay table, well, not all, because there is actually sort of a small enclave just around where Lancaster is, where you also lay the table. Okay, Lancaster is up here. Or, when you're about to faint, do you feel dizzy, giddy, or even mazy? Again, that depends on where you come from. Lancastrians feel mazy. When you sweep the floor, do you use a brush or a broom? A brush up north and a brush in the southwest. But Londoners and others use a broom. Okay. So this is regional difference. And this is just a fact of how the lexicon might be used differently in different parts of the language, parts of the country. There is also, as I just said, social dialect. So we're talking about things like age and gender, and whether you're working class or not, particularly in the British context. Remember from lecture one that the word lovely is quite differently used depending on whether you're an elderly lady or not. So that was about dialect. Words can also vary with respect to, or as a result of, register. With the regional dialect, we're talking about where we come from, or the way I speak gives me away as someone who is a northerner or someone from the Saarland or something like that. Social dialect is what my status is. But register refers to what I'm doing. I'm currently giving a lecture, and I may be using lexical choices that I would not use or that I would not make if I was chatting to my wife. I might be more informal with my wife. Well, I'm pretty sure I'm more informal with my wife because it's a different register. So this is about uses rather than users. And we can look at things like setting, purpose, and participants. So, for example, if I say, cheers, mate, or thank you very much indeed, it's the same thing, but then again not, because it's a completely different level of formality. This is a question of register. I can choose to say cheers, mate, or thank you very much indeed. And I do it according to the setting and the purpose and the participants of the speech situation that I'm currently in. Some people are also talking about things like jargon, etc., when we're talking about register or technical language. For example, HIV positive. That's not positive. It just means something is there that others don't have. And in that sense, it's not positive. That's technical vocabulary. That's perfectly acceptable in certain circles or in certain uses, but may be problematic in others. Okay. Whether you're talking about a nose job or, I think this is, no one says this, but rhinoplasty? Rhinoplasty? No, rhinoplasty? Mm-hmm. It's clearly a question of whether you're a doctor doing the operation or whether you're getting one. Mm-hmm. A nose job. So, technical language. This is partly also related or somehow related to slang, which is a way of using the lexicon, again, to show that you belong to a particular subgroup, but it's a question of choice again. You choose particular words in order to say that you belong to your group of friends, or ethnic group, or age mates. So we're talking about in-group communication here, which is different from a regional dialect or a social dialect. Slang is usually short-lived. Quite a few words survive several hundred years, but often a word might just disappear again after 20 years, or even less than that. One way of looking at register is from a quantitative point of view. When you take a computer and an orthographic definition of word and just say, count words for me, and say which ones are most frequent, and you will then be able to categorize, or not categorize, to say which words are most typical of a particular register. Now, if you look at pop songs, academic papers, spoken English and written English, then if you do this, the difference isn't actually all that big. I, you, me, and the, my, the is here. There is here as well. Okay, there is not most frequent in pop lyrics. It is most frequent in all other registers considered here. Off. Now, off is not among the top 10 in pop lyrics, but there isn't all that much difference. But that's partly, or mostly, because virtually all closed class words. Let's just look at the open class words. And then you see things like, not surprisingly, love and make, well, probably make love, life, boyfriend, there's the boyfriend that, okay, baby, no, need, down, come, time, said, go, say, alone, etc. Makes perfect sense. And that's very different from language, speech, writing, spoken, written, historical, communicative, linguistics. Okay, this is a selection of texts, of course, but and Saussure is there as well, who should ring a bell. So if we just look at the open class items, things become very different, and it is very easy to, I'm still looking for the right word, categorize is not the right word, it's easy to have a blackout. Anyway, to say what type of register it is, on the basis of looking at these words, I'm sure at the moment I put down, switch off the computer, it'll come back to me. But anyway. Yes, so this is different registers. We can also look at differences between spoken and written language, which are sort of major registers, one could say, or actually modes of communication. What is this? Normally, after very heavy rain or something like that, and you're driving along the road and far away you see, well, a series of stripes, etc., etc. You can see that this is a definition or a description of a rainbow. And I think it's easy to see that this is a transcription of spoken language. And if you look at the language that's used, you'll see a lot of repetition of relatively frequent words. Also words like and a few others are repeated more often than we would do in writing. How would this look in what would this look like in writing? And then in the blowing clouds, she saw a band of faint iridescence. Why didn't the other person say iridescence? Such a nice word. Coloring in faint colors a portion of the hill. And forgetting, startled, she looked for the hovering color and saw a rainbow forming itself. In one place it gleamed fiercely. I mean, that's a way to describe it. Again, you wouldn't do this in spoken language for various reasons. Now, this is partly about lexis, the lexicon. Fiercely, gleam, iridescence. You don't speak like that. Well, you can, but then it's a very marked register, or a very formal one. But this isn't only about lexis. This is also about structure. This is also about syntax and grammar. And that's what we are starting to do next week. We'll have four sessions on syntax. It's going to be fun. Yes. Right. See you next Friday.